Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for Monday, September the 27th, 2021. This is Air Force veteran David Corey along with Richard Hurley. We have a very special guest this evening, Jeremy Butler, CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. So please stay tuned. First, though, let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David, and good evening, everybody. It's good to be back. I had to take last week off because of the COVID situation in the family, so it's good to be back on the air again. Hope everybody's doing well, despite the challenges that we're all facing. It's about time when many people, as well as many veteran groups, are reaching out to help those in need. Quite frankly, that's the kind of positive attitude that we need more of, and certainly our guest tonight, Jeremy Butler, displays that. For those listening to our show this evening, I want to remind you that it is a call-in show. We always welcome your views, your comments, and your questions. So you can call us at any time during the show. The number there is 1-888-627-6008, and we really do want your input. And you can have an opportunity to talk to Jeremy a little bit about what he does. Again, that number is 1-888-627-6008, and throughout the show we'll give that number so you can give us a call. But now, over to David.
Thanks, Richard. As I say, our special guest tonight is Jeremy Butler, Chief Executive Officer of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Jeremy Butler joined IAVA with more than 15 years of experience providing substantive and strategic counsel to leaders in high-profile government and private sector offices, to include the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security. He served on active duty in the Navy from 1999 to 2005 as a surface warfare officer. He transitioned to the Navy Reserves and has served there since. After leaving active duty, he started working for a Washington, D.C.-based government contractor and served in a variety of roles to include work for Department of Homeland Security, the Joint Staff, and the Department of the Navy. And throughout, he spent several years back on active duty, both overseas and in the United States. He joined the staff of IAVA in 2015, where he worked in various capacities with the development team, helping with fundraising. And in 2018, he became the Chief Operating Officer, and in 2019 was promoted to CEO. So let's welcome Jeremy Butler to the Veterans News Hour. How are you, Jeremy, and how are things going at IAVA?
Thank you, David. I'm doing well. It's great to be with you guys again, and things are going really well. It's obviously been challenging throughout COVID, and even more so in the recent weeks with everything that's going on in Afghanistan. But one thing that has been very heartening is how strongly the community has come out. The military veteran community, civilian supporters have really rallied. During this time, we've seen really big turnout in terms of support. Lots of veterans are reaching out for support through IAVA's programs, which is good. We, as well as others, are there to help anyone that is needed. And actually, we're getting a lot done in Washington, D.C. as well over the last couple of years, including, fingers crossed, here in the next few months. We've really seen some pretty large successes in terms of lasting legislation and policy changes to help the entire veteran community.
Well, that's great. I know we have lots we can talk about this evening, including the Afghanistan withdrawal, the end of that war, the anniversary of 9/11, veterans suffering from toxic exposures, and military sexual assault, just to name several important issues. So let's start with the topic of the end of the war in Afghanistan and how it ended. What are your thoughts on that, and what are the various reactions by veterans, including veterans in your organization, who served there?
Yeah, it's one of those questions where usually the answer is, hey, you know, the veteran community is a very diverse community. It's hard to summarize any one general feeling, but in this rare case, there actually is a pretty broad general response to what happened in Afghanistan, and that's real frustration and anger. Not over the fact that the president decided to end the 20-year, nearly 20-year conflict there. That is something that, you know, I would say a plurality, if not a majority of veterans kind of agree that the time was right for that. Where the anger comes from is over the way it was done, the speed with which it was done, and the fact that we left behind so many allies, literally the special immigrant visa applicants that worked with the U.S. service members over those 20 years, and who, frankly, were promised by the government, by our State Department, by various members of the military themselves, that because of their service helping U.S. military members complete their missions, you know, we would get them and their family a visa to the U.S. We promised, you know, somewhere upwards of 17, 18,000 individual Afghans who worked with the U.S. over the years. We made that promise to them, and along with that said, we'll get, you know, up to four of your family members out. So we're talking, you know, roughly 80,000 Afghans that we made this promise to. And at the end of the day, after the airlift at the end in Afghanistan, you know, we literally only got out a handful of them. You'll hear the administration talk about 120,000 or so Afghans that they got out. And many of those were truly at-risk Afghans that deserved an opportunity to get out. But at the end of the day, the reality is that it's only a small fraction of those allies that worked directly with the U.S. forces, with the U.S. military, that made it out. And that is something that has caused pretty widespread anger throughout the veteran and military community. And in fact, you see us continuing to work now to make sure that we do not leave them behind, even though we also need to be taking care of those that did get out. And we support the efforts to resettle those Afghans here. There's still a lot more that we need to get out. So that was a long answer to a short question, but I think it's an important one.
Oh, it was. I appreciate that. Jeremy, do you think that veterans of both the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War should speak out more, should do more to share their insights of those wars so that, you know, in 10 or 15 years, they've not become distant memories? You know, I'm reminded that just in the last decade or so, there have been efforts by the VA and others to help document the memories of the greatest generation from World War II. You know, that generation is dying off. But I'm concerned that maybe the lessons are going to be forgotten in 5 or 10 years of Iraq and Afghanistan. And who knows better than the people that actually were there? Do you see any sort of structured programs that might help veterans of both of these wars to share their insights, to have, you know, some sort of an impact?
You know, I wish I could say yes, but I think the sad answer is that no, not really. And I think, you know, you said, you know, we're going to lose the memories of the lessons learned and things like that in 5, 10 years. Unfortunately, I think we already are as a country, and that's what is one thing that's really frustrating. It's something that IAVA is really going to be focused on now. What we're going to be working on next, in addition to trying to get our Afghan allies out, is trying to get the administration to set up, you know, for lack of a better word, an Afghanistan commission, something akin to the 9/11 commission that happened after the September 11th attacks, where it was a nonpartisan look at what went wrong, what happened, and how do we fix these situations. You know, I think all of this sort of ties together in that, you know, I think we as a country, and, you know, this is a nonpartisan, broad brush kind of condemnation here that I think we need to own up to the fact of that for about the last 10 years, you know, the country really has not paid attention to the fact that we were continuing to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, that we still had veterans or still had military members over there, and there was a lot going on. Obviously, a lot of attention was paid once we started the withdrawal from there, but I think if we don't take an honest assessment at what led to the decisions that were made over 20 years of combat in Afghanistan, you know, it's really going to be a disservice to those that fought there. This means, you know, looking at congressional oversight failures. This means looking at why, from a political standpoint, you know, we didn't talk about this in the last couple of presidential campaigns. You know, there's very little to discussion about foreign policy in general, but certainly not about what we were doing in Afghanistan And so there's really, I think, a lot to be looked at now. And it's very important because I think there's real similarities, not just from the withdrawal standpoint, but overall decision-making as well as information being kept from the public as to what we were doing over there. There are real parallels with our engagement in Vietnam. And I think, we didn't necessarily learn the lessons from that war. And if we don't really start taking a hard look at what we've been doing for the last 20 years, we're not going to capture the lessons learned from this war, and we need to make sure that we do. I think that's the best way to honor the 800,000 that fought in Afghanistan, is to make sure that we truly learn the lessons from those two decades of combat.
Jeremy, those are great points, and I certainly applaud your efforts to try to get some sort of commission or something to study these soon as well. Now, one of the concerns I have is that as we saw the Afghanistan war continue just to drag on and on, our original purpose was to go in there and get bin Laden and al-Qaeda. That's why we went into Afghanistan. And, the Taliban's role, whatever role there was, they played. Now they're back in power, and they've got a lot of weapons that we left. And they obviously, to me, had a lot of support from the Afghan people, who basically folded as soon as we left. And so I'm wondering among the various lessons, shouldn't that be something that that people are talking about? And again, going back to my earlier point, I think that who knows better than people that were actually on the ground that perhaps can share their insights. Any thoughts on that?
Absolutely, and you're 100% right. And every time I talk about this, I can't express enough, and I just want to again before I get back, that this isn't a Republican failure, it's not a Democratic failure, it's not an independent failure. This is an American failure to really look hard at these things. And one of the things that has really stood out to me as I talked to veterans since the withdrawal really started is so many of them, from very junior personnel that deployed for maybe just 1 year in Afghanistan to those that had multiple tours and rose to more senior positions, many of them say, I was not surprised at all to see how quickly the Afghan military forces folded. Because I think you have to remember that they didn't lose in combat to the Taliban. I think there's still a lot to be learned here, but at the end of the day, it was a political decision by many individuals and many Afghan military leaders that, hey, you know what? It's not worth trying to get in a firefight with the Taliban. We don't trust our senior leadership. We don't trust that air power is going to come to back us up. And the better decision is to just make a deal with the Taliban, lay down our weapons, and make sure that we and our families live to another day. And so because of that, all of those weapons, as you said, that for the last number of years we have been providing to the Afghan forces, the National Army, the police, the Special Forces, all of those are now pretty much in the hands of the Taliban. And so you can very easily find partisan talking points to blame one group or another. And if you unfortunately look at the congressional hearings that have happened so far, both the House and the Senate Foreign Relations and Foreign Affairs Committees have had several hours of testimony with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. And you saw it from both sides. One side wants to say, hey, this is entirely the Biden administration's fault, and the other side wants to say this is entirely a bad deal that was made by the Trump administration, and it's all their fault. And both of them are right, and both of them are wrong at the same time, and unfortunately, at the end of the day, neither of them are making any substantive advancements or progress towards fixing this situation. Because what you said is absolutely right. We have known for a long time that the Afghan National Army was not nearly as strong as the numbers on paper might allow. And that wasn't news to anyone who has been fighting over there. And so it really does get to that point of how did we continue to double down on a bad decision for so long and basically just kind of hope for the best, which I think was our strategy for the longest time. It's like, hey, we're being told there's 300,000 in the Afghan army. We're giving them lots of weapons and training and money. There's no reason they shouldn't be able to stand on their own 2 feet. And we saw what happened with that. So sorry for going off there a little bit, but I think you were exactly right with what you were saying.
Jeremy, let me interrupt here. Excuse me, David. Recently I had a dinner with about, I guess there were 10 veterans, 8 from Iraq, Afghanistan, and 2 Vietnam vets. And I just kind of posed questions out there. I wanted to listen. I wanted to hear what they all had to say. And so I asked them, you know, first of all, what about the withdrawal? How do you feel about the withdrawal? And it was unanimous at the table. They all looked at me and laughed and said, it should have happened 6-7 years earlier. And I said, well, what's one of your big issues with what happened in Afghanistan? And they actually pointed back to Obama, when Obama sent in 30,000 more troops. And they were there at the time. And then a couple of them said, yeah, we got all these troops coming to help us out, but then we're given this directive that we're going to get ready to leave Afghanistan. So it was like, we got all these troops coming in, but yet now our hands are still tied. And, you know, the mixed messages that were being sent to them, you know, the troops in combat. And then, like you just said, all of them said they couldn't rely upon the Afghanistan army. From the first day they arrived in Afghanistan until the day they left, those guys were just not supportive. So I'll just kind of throw that out to you. What do you think about, you know, their comments?
I think they're exactly right, and I think if you talk to another 100 or so, you would get pretty much the same overall assessment. And I think that's one of the so frustrating things is the fact that that was such a widely felt, understood, held view, whatever word you want to use. Yet that's not, you know, what was necessarily being passed down from the highest levels of the Pentagon. It's not what was being talked about within congressional committees and hearings. And if it was not getting out to the public. It was generally a relatively rosy assessment that things are on track. We're getting folks trained up. The Afghans are fighting on their own. They're doing exactly what we need. But the reality was the entire military complex that we were building for them was one that was designed to very much mimic the kind of Western military that we had, where you have a very centralized command structure, you're reliant on air power, you're reliant on command and control at a very complicated level, and none of that fit the reality on the ground that you found in Afghanistan. It is not, you know, a unified country where the vast majority of the folks outside of Kabul and other major centers, you know, identify themselves first and foremost as Afghans. They might identify themselves as whatever tribe or ethnic group they come from. And none of that was really taken into account. I think we really just turned a blind eye to many of the negative assessments and chose to accept the positive assessments as the right ones, because what that meant is that we were doing the right thing. We didn't have to pay much attention to it. We'd go about our day and carry on. So I'm not surprised that you were hearing that, and I think that's why it really is important that we have this, you know, Afghanistan Commission. Yeah, we can come up with a better name for it, but something that is not led by Congress, because they're going to, I think, revert to the same finger-pointing. And frankly, much of the blame lies on them for not providing their oversight requirements for the last 20 years or so. And it really does need to go way back, because I think many people thought, and I was actually on deployment. I was on deployment as a reservist in the Philippines, of all places, back in 2010 when bin Laden was killed. And that was the general discussion, was, hey, we're pretty much done there, aren't we? Now we've accomplished what we've set out to do. Shouldn't everyone be packing up and heading home now? And I think it was a real surprise that didn't happen, and that instead we really seemed to just double down on it. And I think that goes back to the fact that it was much easier for politicians to support an increase in numbers than to be the politician that advocated ending the war and potentially having it seen as not a clear-cut victory in the terms of a World War II kind of victory. And that's unfortunate, because that's not making the right decision, obviously.
So I'll pose the same question to you that I posed to these guys sitting around the table. Were you surprised when, basically, when we were withdrawing, that the Afghanistan government took off to Pakistan or wherever the heck they went? The soldiers, I saw videos of the soldiers literally taking their uniforms off, putting them down on the ground, getting their civilian outfits on, and putting their guns away. I mean, and as the Taliban's coming into Kabul and these other towns, they're waving at them. Were you surprised by any of that? And why do you think, I mean, where did we go wrong as in America, that is, not realizing that there was this disconnect? I mean, the guys that are sitting around my table all said they weren't surprised at all. And the civilians out there watching this stuff on news, thinking that this was a big blunder, they all said we knew it was going to happen, whether it happened in August or May or next year. That's the way it was going to basically end up. It was going to be a blunder no matter how you looked at it.
Exactly. I'll tell you what surprised me. The biggest thing that surprised me was, as you just mentioned, the fact that Ashraf Ghani fled the country so quickly without a shot being fired in Kabul. I remember very distinctly, I think it was a Sunday morning, you know, waking up and turning on NPR or whatever it was and hearing that news that he had fled. That is what surprised me. And I think that's what gets at America's failure in understanding what was the reality in Afghanistan, is that there was not confidence at any level of that government that they would be able to handle the situation without the strong support of the U.S. And I think we failed to realize how vital our air support, the moral support, frankly, that your average Afghan soldier would feel confident that so long as the U.S. remained in this fight, they could rely on at least us making sure that the Afghan National Army did what they needed to do. So that was the surprise to me, just how quickly it happened and just the fact that at the highest levels of the Afghan government, they were willing to very quickly throw in the towel and leave. And it's what's been surprising really to me is that we have not heard more from him, that it's really been just a cut and run, and it is now someone else's problem. And that's unfortunate because there's so many in Afghanistan that still want to get out, that are still hoping for a better life, and that still feel very much abandoned by the U.S. And you could argue, you know, that it's much larger than that, but I think what you'll hear from so many that bought into what we were selling, which is that, hey, you've got now democracy. You're going to live under democracy. You can fight for your own future. You should get out there, women, girls, get out, get an education, get a job. This is the new future of the country. They very much feel abandoned by America right now.
David, over to you.
Okay, thanks. Jeremy, one thing that when you were mentioning the need for some sort of a commission to study these lessons, about a month ago, as Afghanistan was falling apart with the withdrawal, we did a show on a report which had just been issued earlier in August by the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, John Sopko and his team. You know, that special IG had been established, I think, in 2008, which was already 7 years into the Afghanistan war. And in 2014, they started issuing their periodic lessons learned, which I follow the news all the time, you know, the mainstream media, internet media, and I'll tell you what, it just seems in my perception that the media has did very little, if anything, to publicize sort of the ongoing reports of the special IG, who I was focusing on the reconstruction issue, but offered a lot of excellent lessons and analysis in its August report, very critical. I mean, there's lots of you could spend many shows talking about it, but I hope perhaps Congress steps up to the plate, or we're just going to repeat this, and it's just going to be tragic. I think it already is. But any other thoughts before we move on to some other issues?
No, just to say, I'm glad you brought that up, though, because I literally have several of those reports, and you're absolutely right. The Special IG for Afghanistan Reconstruction is an organization that has been around for over a decade now. They publish quarterly reports, or should they say they published quarterly reports, because they did publish their last one. And it was a very open, honest, and clear-eyed assessment of what was going on in Afghanistan every stage of the way. And unfortunately, especially for those that worked so hard on those reports, I think they were completely ignored. You go and look at them, I think you're going to get the reality of what was happening. And for whatever reason, you're right. The media didn't pay them attention. Congress didn't pay them any attention. But if you look at them, especially the last one that you said was published back in August, I mean, it basically says, this is not working, and if we pull out, it's going to be bad news. And they had been saying that for a while. This wasn't a new assessment that they came across. Quarterly reports going back years, basically saying we're spending a lot of money and getting very little for what we are spending.
And in some ways, it wasn't merely a 20-year long war, as the IG said in his report. In some ways, it was as if it was a series of 1 year wars repeated 20 different times. You know, we're
exactly
with the we all know, you know, those who served in the military, people come and go with a deployment or a PCS, and the corporate knowledge and continuity is lost. But at the end of the day, when you have so many different players involved, there's no ultimate accountability for any of the. For any of the senior leadership or the generals or the admirals, there just seems to be no accountability. You know, people get their medals, their awards at the end of their 6 months or 12 months. And what a tremendous success, so, you know, or so they want people to think. And it's been this cumulative total disaster, in my opinion. But anyway, let's, Rick, you want to start off on our next topic. Let's talk about the toxic contamination issues. Rick,
sure. Yeah, Jeremy, tell us what's going on as far as the issue of support for the veterans who suffer from the effects of the toxic contamination, such as the air burn pits.
Absolutely. So this one is a bit simpler. So the long story short is there are two major pieces of legislation, one in the House of Representatives and one in the Senate. The House of Representatives bill is the larger of the two. It actually basically highlights 23 different illnesses and cancers and says that if you as a veteran or a military member served in any of these many, many countries, and it actually goes back pre-9/11, it goes back to 1990 and the start of Gulf War, because it includes Gulf War illnesses and all of the sort of hazy sicknesses that many that fought in the first Gulf War have come down with. It includes them. So there's 23 illnesses in that bill, and it says if you fought in one of these conflicts or served in one of these countries and you come down with this condition, you are presumed to have a service-connected disability, and that means you can get VA health care and potentially even a disability payment, you know, if your sickness, your illness is so debilitating. The Senate version is a little bit scaled down from that. It has basically 15 of those 23, so not quite as robust, but still a very robust bill. And we could get into the reasons why they have differing numbers, but that's not really important, because what's ultimately important is that both of these bills got a very high score by the Congressional Budget Office, which is an organization within the government that basically, the word they use is scores any legislation, any potential legislation, to say this is how much it's going to cost. And they err on the side of caution, and so it's basically kind of the worst-case scenario. And in this case, both bills came back with very high cost scores, which isn't surprising, because what you're saying is there's a lot of veterans out there that were affected by a lot of different diseases, especially rare cancers, long-term debilitating illnesses because of their time in service, many of which were self-inflicted injuries, especially when you talk about burn pits and other toxins that the U.S. government used, by the way that they were done, many, many veterans and military members got sick because of those. So there's a lot of sicknesses and illnesses out there that would be included, and if all of these vets came down with them and had to be covered by the government for health care, it would cost a lot of money because health care is expensive in this country. So all that is to say, right now where we stand is both bills are on the floor in the House and the Senate, and we're kind of waiting for the various committees to continue their work, to look at the scores, and what is probably going to happen is one or both of these bills is going to come up before the end of the year. We think what will probably happen is that there will be some sort of compromise. And I say that because there's a lot of other expensive legislation out there. If you and your listeners are paying attention, you know there's lots of talk around infrastructure bills and needs to raise the debt ceiling, things like that. Unfortunately, these bills are legislation that would add to those grand totals for how much we would be passing this year. That said, I don't say any of that as a means to say that it shouldn't happen. I think this is vital that we do this, and we are working very closely with both the House and Senate Veteran Affairs Committees to make sure that we get something done this year. I think there's a very good chance that it will, but I think a lot of it will be driven by what happens here in the next couple of weeks as the House and Senate look at the infrastructure legislation, look at the debt ceiling, look at the continuing resolution that needs to pass to continue to fund the government, things like that. I think all of that is going to play in, but I think we will see a vote on one, both, or a combined version of those two legislations, probably that limits the number of illnesses that are included in this round, and we'll try again to get the rest of them included down the line. That's my speculation as to where we're going to end up. So we're in a very good spot, but as is always the case, it's going to come down to the wire with what we can get past this year.
So it's going to be like the Agent Orange and Camp Lejeune.
Basically. Exactly. No, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah, where we continue to chip away at it. Our goal is to not make it fester as long as those illnesses have, but I'm giving you the reality of things here, certainly not where I want it to be. My ideal would be that we pass the House legislation this year. That's the one with 23 cancers and illnesses to them, but I think that's not what's probably going to happen. It's going to be a smaller one, and then we're going to have to continue this fight down the line. You're right.
You know, my concern always with Congress and these politicians is that veterans issues aren't sexy. They all show up, you know, when it's time to be reelected, they show up and hold a flag and take pictures with veterans and everything else. But when they go back to D.C. and now they've got to vote on veterans issues that impact veterans, to benefit veterans, they fall way short. And it just seems like that's what's going to happen here again.
I couldn't agree more. It's 100% correct, and it's frustrating because I think every one of those members of Congress are also going to go home and say, hey, we're taking care of our veterans. Nothing's more important to us than our military and our veterans. We're going to do everything that we can to make sure that they get the care that they deserve. But then behind the scenes, and like you said, the nuts and bolts of this legislation, it's not sexy, and it doesn't make the headlines, and very few people pay attention to what's going on within the committee levels and things like that. And so they don't have to worry about getting called out for making decisions around these types of things, and that's why it doesn't get the exposure that it needs to. And so that's why we continue to try and raise it. We continue to make sure that the public is aware of it, and why I appreciate, you know, being able to come on your show to talk about things like this, because the more that members of Congress hear from the public that they need to support these things, the better off we'll all be.
Well, Jeremy, let's also talk about another issue that's really kind of dear to me, and it's military sexual assault. I've represented and continue to represent many veterans who are victims of sexual assault in the military. As a matter of fact, over the last year and a half, I've probably resolved a half a dozen to a dozen MST cases, and a couple of them go back where the actual assault occurred in the 90s, and the veteran has been fighting since the early 2000, mid-2000. I pick up the case somewhere around 2011 or 12, and then these cases finally, after I get them to the Board of Veteran Appeals, get resolved. What are IAVA's recommendations in this regard?
Thank you. No, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is another priority to us. So our big fight right now is to get the military to take the prosecution and management of sexual assault and sexual harassment cases out of the chain of command and give it to the trained judge advocate corps, so that if you, as a soldier, sailor, airman, you know, are making an accusation that you are sexually assaulted, sexually harassed, it doesn't get handled within your chain of command. That's what has been the way it's done, and we know that that has failed so many, and not just women. You know, we talk about this all the time.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, this is often portrayed as a women's military or women in the military, women veterans issue. The fact is, there's a large number of men that are sexually assaulted each year within the military.
I have a number of those cases, too.
Exactly. Yeah. And so what our goal is to get this taken out of the chain of command. Here, again, we've got kind of another good news, bad news story in that we are very close. So, again, we've got legislation. This one has the long name of the Military Justice Improvement and Increasing Prevention Act, MJIIPA. This has been spearheaded by Senator Gillibrand of New York. She's been working on this legislation for years, and we've supported with her. And we finally, this Congress, it's had a groundswell of support. I think that finally members of Congress really are realizing that this is a major problem, and every other issue or every other attempted solution that they have tried has failed. They see that the numbers continue to go up and not down. And so there is roughly about 70 senators that support this legislation, but it's been held up by coming to a vote on the Senate floor by the chair and the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And that's a whole other story we can get into, but I'll just leave that part of that. However, what is hopefully going to happen is that this legislation will be included in the National Defense Authorization Act this year, the must-pass legislation that funds the military, and our goal is to get it passed that way. Now, the details here and why I say it's a good news, bad news story is I think it's very likely that at least the part about taking sexual assault, sexual harassment crimes out of the chain of command, I think that is going to make it in and that's going to pass. One of the changes that we worked with Senator Gillibrand on this year is the realization that if you only take sexual assault and sexual harassment cases out of the standard chain of command, then you could end up actually creating a situation where you're sort of stigmatizing the men and women that are making these accusations. And in, you know, you understand this, you know, in the very male-dominated world that is the military, you can see where that could cause a backlash and could actually result in some people maybe not wanting to push forward their cases because they're going to say, oh, you know, you're good to go now into the women's court or something like that. So what our goal is to actually not just limit it to sexual assault and sexual harassment, but all felonies, all non-military related felonies. So there's murder, there's rape, there's pornography, child pornography, anything that isn't related to or specific to the military, any felony crimes that aren't specific to the military, these crimes should be taken out of the standard chain of command focus and put and given to a special judge advocate general court within the military and let them handle the investigation, the prosecution, and the dissemination of these cases. And if you make it that larger pool where it's basically all non-military felonies, you're not going to get that potential stigma that's created there. And frankly, I think you're going to find that there is a better handling of these really major criminal cases within the military that you hopefully end up getting cases handled better and get more justice, frankly, out of the military justice system, which, you know, the joke is that, you know, that, you know, there is no the biggest act or the I'm losing my joke here, but you know that the military justice system is kind of a fake thing there, and so I think we can get some real respect and belief back in that if we get this. So we'll see what happens. It's basically going to come down to some behind the scenes work between the House and the Senate to see if the full bill gets into that would take all felonies out, or if it gets watered down to just the sexual assault, sexual harassment cases.
Very good.
If I could add something about that, my observations from having been in the service, but also representing veterans, male and female, victim of this. In addition to reforming the Uniform Code of Military Justice, I think there needs to be, they need to figure out more effective ways to identify the predators that are in the service and the ones that that can do even the most harm. They all do harm, but the ones that can do the very most harm are the ones that for instance, are the drill instructors, the training instructors, the mm-hmm. NCOs at boot camp level, because I've represented veterans that served as long ago as the early 60s up until recent years. And those people, because of the power they have, with the young troops, is the lifelong damage they cause to these young people. There needs to be, it's one thing to say yes, they need to be severely punished. There needs to be a change in the UCMJ on how that's handled. Yes, but by that point, the damage has already been done. They need to figure out a way how the military can better identify, predators.
Yep.
Just like the Catholic Church has had to revamp how it selects people, for the priesthood, for instance, because of the scandals in the Catholic Church. The military needs to do a much better job. One of my current clients, young man whose life's been totally destroyed because of sexual assault by a male drill sergeant. It's horrific. I mean, he goes in an idealistic 18-year-old or 17-year-old when he actually joined, and it's just horrific to see how, to actually see on a human level how much damage can be done. So anyway, I wish you the best of success and those issues. Now, Jeremy, before we go, we've got about 10 minutes left. I know from the IAVA's website, the organization's priorities. Can you share with us some of the ones we haven't talked about yet, some of your priorities, particularly for Congress?
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that. So there's a few others that we definitely maintain as a priority. One is around kind of expanding on what we were just talking about, is improving services for women veterans. This is really more focused on the VA to make sure that the VA is a more welcoming and useful place for women veterans. Right now there's a lot of talk about community care and things like that, and unfortunately for women veterans, for many of the issues that they might go to the VA for, they get outsourced to community care because historically there just haven't been that many women veterans, and so VAs have been built and designed around taking care of the male veterans. But we have women veterans is certainly the fastest growing demographic within the military veteran community, and that's going to continue to be the case for a long time to come. And so we need to make sure that the VA is a more welcoming place and is better equipped to handle the needs of our women veterans. So that's a big one. We continue to support the GI Bill. There's lots of ways in which the GI Bill needs to be improved and strengthened to make sure that it continues to be available for those that need it. Let's see. Another is cannabis and access to medicinal alternative therapies. That's a huge one, is making sure that members of the military and veteran community, I should say the veteran community, really more so than the military community, have access to alternative therapies to include cannabis and other options that often can be gained in the civilian world. Cannabis is now legal in some 34, 35 states throughout the U.S., but in no VAs can they talk to you or prescribe cannabis, even though it's been found to be incredibly successful and useful in treating pain, PTSD symptoms, so many different ways. So we want more research and hopefully an increasing access to that type of care. So I'll pause there for a minute.
Those are all great issues to talk about. We've talked about them on some of our prior shows. And another one that I know your organization is concerned about is the issue of suicide among both those still on active duty as well as veterans, the suicide rate, which is higher than the civilian population. Any thoughts, thoughts on that issue?
Absolutely. No, and I'm glad you brought it up because I don't want to downplay it by any means. So there's a couple of things. One, I will say the VA comes out with its report every year on veteran suicide. It just came out with its report that actually showed for the first time in a long time a decline in the number of suicides within the community. That said, by the way that they do their research, and this can be another whole sidebar, it's basically looking at suicides up to about 2 years ago. So they kind of lag a little bit because they are taking a deep dive into to the historicals. And it's fine, we understand that. But unfortunately, what that doesn't show us is what's going on right now, what's going on during COVID, the pandemic, and things like that. We've definitely seen a spike in veterans reaching out for mental health care during the pandemic, just as all Americans are having an increased need for mental health care. So we do have that good news, and it does seem that the pandemic has not resulted in an increase in suicides, but we're still waiting on the hard data for that. Number two is that last year we had a really successful bit of legislation that passed, the Commander John Scott Hannon Act, something that IVA and many veterans organizations backed and worked so hard to get passed through Congress. One of the big things that it does is it provides grants for local providers throughout the country, civilian providers, not through the VA, but local organizations that provide mental health care, treatment, outreach, that type of thing, especially in rural areas where you often don't get VAs and you might not get other civilian providers and things like that. It provides grants to them to expand their ability to treat veterans where they are and where they're often undertreated. One of the big things we need to do now is work with VA and work with Congress to make sure that that program gets implemented fully and quickly. So we're not necessarily pushing more legislation right now. There's still certainly some changes that could be improved, but the biggest thing is to make sure that we roll out and implement the Commander Hannon Act as quickly and robustly as possible, because I think it's going to see real success in bringing those numbers down.
Wow, that's a lot, and I applaud the very positive programs and policy agendas that you have. Jeremy, how can veterans learn more? I know about IAVA, and how can they join? How can they support IAVA?
No, that's great. I appreciate it. You can just simply go to IAVA.org. That's our website. You're going to be able to find our policy agenda. You find the Big Six, the issues that we just talked about. Another thing that I'll touch on, you can just click on the membership tab and join. I should emphasize, anyone can join and become a member of IAVA. You don't have to have served. You don't have to be in the military. You don't have to have family in the military. Anyone can be a member of IAVA, and we're going to keep you informed about all these things. We're going to tell you how that you can help by making it easy for you to reach out to your members of Congress to tell them what legislation to support, just as we talked about. But if you are a military or veteran member, you can take an extra step, and when you join and you note in your membership page, and really joining is easy, it's free. We really, at a minimum level, we just need your name and an email address so we can contact you and keep you informed. But if you also click on there that you're either currently serving or you're a veteran, we can do some follow-up and confirm your military or veteran service. And what that means is that allows you to take part in our annual member survey, which is going on right now. This is a huge survey that drives all of the work that we do in D.C. There's very, really, truly very few surveys like it, and one of the things that really differentiates it is that we do confirm and verify that every military or veteran that is taking part in the survey actually is a military or veteran member. There's a lot of surveys out there that anyone can technically take. They say, you know, we want to hear from the military veteran community, but then they just take it on trust and faith that non-vets are taking the survey. We confirm it, and because of that, it is really trusted and respected within Congress, within the media, within the administrations, and so it is used to drive a lot of the work that we do and to back up that work, and you'll see many members of Congress, their staff, many members of the administration, the VA, et cetera, really wants to know what our members are saying, and that all comes from the results of this survey. And so if you go, the survey is going on right now. If you're a military or veteran member, go to IAVA.org, click on membership, and you can join, and click that you're a member of the military or the veteran community, and we'll follow up with you and get you a link so that you can take that survey and make your voice heard, and that will directly drive all the work that we're talking about right now and what we're going to do in the future.
Oh, that's super. Before we go, I want to give Rick an opportunity. Rick, any other thoughts or questions for Jeremy?
Well, I heard a statistic last couple weeks ago on CBS, and I just want to throw this by you because I was kind of shocked. And I've mentioned this to David in our prior shows. And what they said was that there have been more suicides by Afghanistan veterans than those that died in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's really tragic. And I think
I was shocked. I was shocked when I heard that. I mean, is that accurate?
It's definitely accurate that we lose more military members and veterans to suicide than to combat. I would have to double check. And it probably is definitely true within the Afghanistan side specifically. I think that was what you said, especially because we have lost so relatively few to combat in Afghanistan, especially over the last few years, is as we reduced the role that we're playing. But absolutely, without a doubt, I mean, we lose, you know, more than 6,000 military and veterans to suicide every year, and that's far more than we lost in the 20 years of fighting in Afghanistan, for sure. And so it's absolutely true, and there's so much more. And the reality is that's probably low. That is probably undercounting, because not every suicide, especially those that are completed within the veteran community, don't always get tracked back to being included in that veteran total, because unless someone knows enough about that person's background to know that he or she served, it's very possible that many of these suicides are getting logged and not getting included in the veteran total. So, you know, you hear the number 20 a day. Sometimes people say 22 a day. Sometimes people say 18 a day. Whatever that number is that you're using, you can pretty much rest assured that that's a low ball number. So there's a lot of work to be done, certainly within the military and veteran community, but frankly, within the American society in general. I mean, suicide really is an American problem, and we really need to make more focus on it, increase our resources available for those that need it, and to reduce the stigma of talking about mental health and mental health care. That's the big first step.
You know, Jeremy, I've been recovering now. I've been sober now 14 years. I'm very active in the AA community. And one of the things that I don't think that the people, when they listen to the suicides, take into consideration is the number of alcohol and drug-related deaths, which are just another slow way of killing yourself. You know, you don't need to pull a trigger mm-hmm. or hang yourself. You can just drink yourself to death, and that's just another way, another form of suicide.
No, it's absolutely right, and I appreciate you sharing that, because I think, you know, I think the more folks that have gone down that path and that are willing to talk about it, I think that goes a long way. You certainly hear that within the veteran community. I mean, they want to talk to other veterans that have dealt with the same issues that they're dealing with, and they're a lot more receptive to it. That's why we get so many spouses that'll call out to our quick reaction force, you know, this 24/7 veteran support line that we have, because they want to connect their spouse to a veteran, because the veteran's going to be much more likely to listen to a fellow vet who's been down that path than, you know, to have a spouse tell them, hey, you need to get help. You know, tired, and I'm scared of seeing you this way.
Oh, those are great points. And the peer-to-peer counseling, we hear that, how important that is. Well, Jeremy, we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for being on our show. You made it a great show. And this show will be an archived podcast on our show website within a few days, so it can be shared and people can listen to it if they missed it tonight. I'd like to thank you and everyone in IAVA for all you do for veterans. Anytime you'd like to be back on our show, you have an open invitation. Please just let us know.
That's outstanding. Thank you, David. Thank you, Richard. I appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Jeremy.
We certainly Keep look
up the good
forward
work.
To sharing the show. Thank you. You do
Thanks.
The same.
Stay Take well. Care. Take care. Well, thanks very much to our special guest, Jeremy Butler, CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Their website is easy to remember. It's IAVA.org. You can join tonight, sign up, and if you're able to help them, support them in any way, including financial, that would be wonderful. They're doing a lot of great work for veterans. Well, Rick, we're about out of time. If you want to take us to our Coaching Into Care reminder, please.
Absolutely. Coaching Into Care program. This is a program that for veterans and their families. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. That number is 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I would like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, we just got finished talking to Jeremy about this. The Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, it's time for us to go this evening. We would like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Corey and Hurley Law Group, and allow us to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, stay safe and stay well. Have a great week.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.